you all again. There was one item left on the list that Joe had given me of topics that you were interested in. I was going to speak earlier, and then my brother died, so I was off doing the things that we do. I'm happy to be back with you now. So here's a talk about the time we're in and how the Buddha way, this path, sometimes referred to as the Fourth Noble Truth, meets us here. The item on your list was the Eightfold Path, and I realized I don't think I've ever talked about the Eightfold Path before. And as I think I said in my letter to you, it felt more like, you know, a path under rain, under snow, where the streams sort of get braided along the hillsides. I'll actually be more talking about the six paramitas, which are the Mahayana version of the Eightfold Path. So just different number, same idea. And here in this cozy room that I always feel is infused with the love and the faith and the doubt and the perseverance that you bring to it each week, under the blessing of rain and snow from an enfolding sky here in midwinter, a time of rest and reflection, of using what's stored and preparing for a season of growth by fasting in some ways. An image from the I Ching, a book of change, comes up for me in a time like this, the reading that's called The Taming Power of the Small. Not the grand gesture, but the small moves. And so this may be the tenor of discussion this morning of the six paramitas, the Mahayana version of the Eightfold Path. Paramitas are sometimes there are two different descriptions of the root of that, but that which brings you to the other shore, across, brings you across, beyond, going beyond. And sometimes as the sort of supreme expression of how things are, para meaning sort of above and beyond. It's really so what I really want to talk about is what we have to offer to our ancestors in gratitude, to our descendants in love and humility, and to our companions, you know, of all realms, in solidarity, this inquiry of our hearts and minds, this small move we can offer together. We'll begin with reimagining a path. Reimagining is something that happens in the dark. And at least some of us are seeing this time, centuries after what was called the Enlightenment, as the Endarkenment. One Zen ancestor said, "The bright path that the ancestors knew is right in front of you in everything you see and hear." The bright path that the ancestors knew is right in front of you in everything that you see and hear. And right now, it can be hard to hear those words without also noticing, really? The road that brought us here? Bright? Right in front of me can look pretty dark and scary sometimes. So this is what we'll feel our way into this morning. I didn't time myself, so I we'll see what happens. So reimagining a path. Oddly, as I felt my way into this, it begins with karma, the karma of being human, the causes and conditions. Fortunately, we are here to do it. To me, that's the core of karma. Fortunately, we are here to turn the karma of our ancestors, to re-envision, to find a new way. What is it to be human in this time, when we might be feeling a mounting sense of horror at what our species has done and is doing? It's as if our very nature as humans, all the causes and conditions of being human on this earth, our karma, our ways so far, has brought us to an impasse. Our gorgeous brains, our upright bodies, our bright, far-seeing eyes, our so clever tongues, our unbelievably knowing and skillful hands with their opposable thumbs, our ability to make communities that grow and spread and endure for millennia. All of this brings us here. All of our beautiful gifts of being human. Just by being successfully human, have we walked into a dark woods and now find ourselves lost, stuck, where the only light is the light of fires burning? We don't know what to do sometimes, how to be, how to go on walking a path as humans. What do you do when you can't see? What lights your way? The Buddha's last words are said to be a lamp for yourselves. There's an implication here that I think may be sort of the leitmotif of my exploration with you today. What if we actually have what we need? What's a path in the dark like then? There's a scratchy voice in the room. There's a koan that says, there's no oil in the house. There's no way to make a light. But I know a way to bless this poverty. In the dark, feel your way along the wall. It feels like a good koan for right now, in that it seems to be affirming that new vision begins with not seeing. Revision emerges from no vision. But then we can ask, what does our Buddhist practice, our Buddhist tradition, bring to bear on a pathless path? How to walk a path that must be created by our very feet feeling their way on the ground? Is there a way even to learn to walk it with open-hearted confidence, with courage? Norman Fisher has a new book out called The World Could Be Otherwise, which is actually his book about the paramitas. I haven't read it, but in an interview, he argued that in a time of climate crisis with no vision, we're doomed. If we're just relying on our technologies, on what we humans already have developed to do. Because the problems are not scientific. They are lack of altruism. So how do we go beyond what we can see? And that's paramitas. So it's a perfect time to look at paramitas. Buddhism's powerful ancient advice to bring to bear on this problem. And here's a, for instance, actually, another con. Zhaozhou taught, the greatest way is not difficult if you don't pick and choose. As soon as I speak, he says, you'll think, that's picking and choosing. Or, that's clear. But I don't identify with clarity. Can you live this way? A student asked, if you don't identify with clarity, what do you live by? It's a fair question, right? If you don't identify with clarity, what do you live by? Zhaozhou said, again, I don't know. Can you see how he's actually answering the question? I live by, I don't know. Look, the student asks, if you don't know, why do you say that you don't identify with clarity? At that point, Zhaozhou said, well, when you ask that question, you already have it. When you ask the question, you already have it. And so this is not unlike that point that Keats made, that we can, with practice, develop what he called negative capability. Negative capability, the courage, the ability to tolerate uncertainty. Something we can develop. The capability, and I think of it as a, like, capacious, right? A cape. Something large and roomy, yeah? The capability to tolerate uncertainty. And I would add that when you cannot see, you learn to listen. To bring all of your senses to bear. So that your unknowing, your darkness, is lit by the radiance of everything that you meet. The wisdom of the kettle, the cat, the homeless person, the wind and rain, everything that you coexist with, it is made of me, I am made of it. That radiance. This is quite different than the attitude that says, I made this, and when it breaks or I'm done with it, I'll throw it away and invent something better. Feels very different, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. In the dark, we can't afford such foolishness, even though the tools that it has developed may be essential for us. A shift is needed. One thing that I love most about the Buddha way is that it relies on the kind of vision you do in the dark, right? That kind that brings all of your senses to bear, that is close in and personal. It's what you've already got. Another koan has Dongshan, when asked what is the way, saying, I might have said this down here before, this may sound familiar. He said, in the dark, darken again. In the dark, darken again. Further in, not trying to get out, right? And he said, follow the bird path. Huh? Follow the bird path. And thirdly, in the vastness, reach out a hand. So three things, in the dark, darken again. Follow the bird path. In the vastness, reach out a hand. This is the sort of advice the Buddha way likes to offer. When walking a path you cannot see, Don't keep trying to rely on the map you no longer have, or the tools in the backpack you had lost, or perhaps even the ground ahead that you can no longer see. Buddhist wisdom is not going to try to replace your lost map with a better map, or your backpack with another set of tools. Its advice is, turn the light inward. The brilliance of your human imagination is that it sees in the dark. So this is how I'm seeing the six paramitas, as a description more than prescription. Instead of, here's what the path looks like, it offers, here's what walking the path can feel like. It's not difficult. If you will accept the great gift of your lack of clarity, the radiance that is right inside this darkness. So, to the particulars, how might this work? Fortunately, it starts right where you are. Yeah, as if there were any other place. I don't know about you, but at one point in my life, I had a sudden revelation, which was that I thought that there was somebody who was kind of like behind here somewhere who knew how I should be doing this. And who would do it better, undoubtedly, than I'm about to do it, right? All of a sudden I realized, wait, there can't be that person, because there's only one person who can do this. And there's only one person who can do it the way life wants to do it in this particular body, in this spot. So we start from there, don't we? There ain't no other person that knows how I should be doing this. And so the first paramita arises, generosity, dana, offering. This is to say, your sometimes desperate desire to help is exactly your starting place. It's the power of your bodhicitta, your desire to awaken with and for everybody. So trust it. Develop it by realizing it. It wants to come forth as generosity. Let it. That thing that you already feel, let it come forth. Let it come through those hands, those thousand hands and eyes of bodhisattva generosity that are your hands. Let it. When you don't like your options, never mind. Don't worry about whether you want to at the moment. That's pretty much irrelevant. How do I feel about what I know I need to do right now? Not my business, right? Let it out, let it come forth. Do something. Build this doing something into your life, and it will be the platform on which everything else rests. Allow that love that rises from the core of you, that is your birthright, allow it to come forth from you. Do something. Respond to the invitation that life holds out to you. When your heart calls, just answer. That's number one. That's all I have to say about generosity so far. So then number two, the second paramita is described as discipline. Sila is the Sanskrit word. Morality, ethical conduct. So you say you don't know how to do number one, generosity. That's okay. Number two says, just keep walking. just don't shut up that little voice inside that says, keep practicing. With your speech, with your actions, with your livelihood. Once you have allowed your bodhisattva vow, your vow to become useful, your vow to help whatever situation you're in, right? Which is what our awakening is made out of. When that's the root of everything, it will talk to you everywhere. You know, not always in a sweet and gentle voice, maybe, but it'll be talking to you. Meat won't taste so good, maybe. You'll see that stealing leaves you lonely. Sharing warms your heart. You'll be so listening to the mysterious truth of things just as they are. That light that's preached by each and everything is always here talking to us, helping us. You'll be so listening to that that you won't feel driven to use your speech to control someone or something or a situation. So do you see how I'm spelling out the sila, the ethical practices, the vows, coming from this place? That not to I vow not to kill comes out of, wow, when we are like this, all going along in an interwoven ongoingness, there's nothing I can kill that won't be me, you know. And when I notice that if I steal someone's time, someone's energy, someone's delight, let alone someone's wherewithal, you know, and there's so many ways in our culture that we're doing this without even thinking about it. When I feel the feeling of that, when I actually just feel how that feels in me, it feels shitty. And I want to practice doing otherwise. Yeah, I want to practice not stealing. And I can do that. I don't need somebody to tell me how not to steal. Right? And so not to lie, right? When the truth is just right here, being here for me all the time, what would I, here I sit preaching to you guys, so wash my mouth out with soap, because our precept not to lie says not to preach a single word. Which is also about, you know, not to try to control other people's behavior with your speech, right? Hopefully, I think you know I'm not trying to control your behavior. Okay, so that's a for example, and we have 10 of those that are called the grave or heavy precepts or the bodhisattva vows. But can you see how all of them just emerge out of letting that central core vow be running the ship? So, third one, kshanti, your patience. As we do this, right, as we just keep walking and meet what we meet with our hearts open and take the falls, right? You know, take how it feels when I steal and realize I caused harm. We're developing patience, our ability to withstand what comes. So patience in the paramitas gets defined in several different ways, which is really lovely. The ability to endure hardship, right? Because we keep falling on our noses and it hurts. And we keep losing what we love and it hurts. We keep getting sick and heading towards dying, and we don't like that either. The ones we love are dying and it hurts. Our world is suffering and it hurts. So the patience to endure hardship, and we, in order to not only rescue but renew and support life on this planet are going to have to endure some hardship. What we're not used to. We're pretty used to being pretty comfortable. We will need to be uncomfortable. Just by going on and noticing and opening our heart to ourselves and others, that's how we are already developing the ability to endure that hardship, to be patient with ourselves and other people, other beings, and to stand the essential truths of life and death. To stand it, that the beauty, the very beauty of this life that we love relies on death. Inseparable from the fact that we grow old and get sick and die, and that we will lose everything. And so I had a quote, but I didn't have time to find it again, that said that death is the beginning point of joy. And that really felt like it connected to this particular paramita, yeah? That to stand it, that we are so temporary, so delicate, and everything else is too, and that we all are not, that nothing is just as we think it is, even though we try to pin it down, that life is so beautifully unpinnable. It won't stay put for us to get a good snapshot. The snapshot, as we know, is already not true, the second after. And so all of that, the Lankavatara calls developing the forbearance of no self. Forbearance is an interesting word, isn't it? In order to be helpful, we have to be able to tolerate how changeable, how interwoven, how unfixable it all is, how beautifully so. We learn to stand it. There's no special sauce. When we let our deep desire to awaken with and for everyone, because we are inseparable and ineffably beautiful, be the energy under our feet, that energy that we draw from the earth. When we listen with our whole being, we know we can keep going together. That's Kshanti. The practice of being human. So those first three are just about the practice of being human. The next three have to do with how does this Buddha way help us do this? How am I doing on time? Am I okay?
Fine.
All right. Number four, as we develop our patience through our generosity and our persistence, we also grow our energy, virya, joyful, even heroic effort, courage. It's something we must do alone, but can only do because we do it together. It's kind of a nice paradox, right? You have to do it alone, but you can only do it because we do it together. The bird path. Fortunately, the sky is full of the traces of millions of bird paths. That energy. So it kills me when people try to take the paramitas or the vows and the precepts and sort of make them something that lays on you like a heavy, you know, load you've got to carry. No, it's mostly we've got to let go of the load, right, in order to let the energy come up from inside, from everywhere. The energy that the snow brings us. And so we practice, number five, meditation, dhyana, which is the root of the word Zen. So we are able to relax with all of the help that life offers us just by virtue of being part of it, with the blessing of snow falling on us. Just exactly what we have, yeah? We are able to relax with that help long enough to breathe and be human. When we sit together, when we sit alone, it's really just the practice of breathing and being human. You know, it's not that complicated, right? And yet, fundamental, foundational. And by breathing and being human, number six, we are able to touch and deepen our prajna, our wisdom, our understanding. And this is way, not destination. We won't ever be done. Touching again and again the teaching that we can now receive, that is everywhere, in every moment, the teaching of the clouds and stones, of you, of me, of the chair, in its own chairness. Just this, teaching how it is to be just this. That's all we really need to know, right? How is it to be just this? The chair doesn't have a problem with it. So, nothing lacking, even now, especially now. Because now we see, not with clarity, but with love, how we are all intermingling, ongoing, ineffably beautiful, the true expression of this incomprehensible being. And so our love rises up, and we are back with number one, with generosity, with bodhicitta. It's not a line, right? It's a fabric. One of our teachers, Lin Ji, in the Zen tradition, says something lovely about this. He says, followers of the way, the Dharma of the Buddhas calls for no special undertakings. Just act ordinary, without trying to do anything particular. If, wherever you are, you take the role of host, then whatever spot you stand in will be a true one. Then, whatever circumstances surround you, they can never pull you awry. You don't have to strive for benefits. It's not about getting something, right? Benefits will come of themselves. Even when you're faced with bad karma left over from the past, or the five crimes that bring on the hell of incessant suffering, these will, of themselves, become the great sea of emancipation. Even all of your stuff, the stuff you wish you hadn't done, that is the great sea of your emancipation. And I had one other quote that I had never met before from this book by Roberto Colasso, Ka, which has a wonderful telling of the story of the Buddha. And I had marked this at once, but I only just found it today. Ananda looked up at the Buddha and asked him the question he'd been putting off for days and days. How can awakening come about? The Buddha was tracing signs on the ground with a stick. He went on doing so. In a flat voice, he said, in many ways, looking at a peach blossom, hearing a stone strike bamboo, hearing the drum announcing dinner, walking on a bamboo stick, looking at the forest and the mountains, looking at yourself in a barber's mirror, falling to the ground in a cloister, tying a noose around your neck, pouring water on your feet and watching it being soaked up by the dry earth. So maybe that's a place to stop. And there's time for conversation. Not as much as I thought I would leave, but we got some. So what wants to come in?